my email address is PWNC system, no. Which one of you found it?
Oh, yeah.
My mom was born in DW, you mean my All right. How did you do with the homework? Okay, the linkage or the complementation? Name it? Did anybody figure out how to approach the complementation table?
I think so.
Okay.
Which one is it, by the way? Complementation table. Let's see.
So this one?
What did you try to do?
Which complementation table? Or which table is the complementation table?
On the
this one. Oh, I found
it. So I gave you a set of complementation data. I tried an experiment in which two haplomutants were crossed pairwise. So there's a mutant collection of temperature sensitive mutants, right? And they were pairwise and an alpha mutant and a beta mutant. And they were pairwise crossed if the diploids were selected. Right? How were the diploids selected? So we would say they were selected because they had complementary oxygen trophies. The haploids came, one of them had a TS mutation that precluded growth at 37, and the other one had an amino acid oxygen trophy that precluded growth without the amino acid. So if you save them at 37 degrees without the amino acid, and the mutations are recessive, right, and the diploid could grow by neither of the haploids. Okay. So remember that's how the diploids are selected. And the diploids are starved for nitrogen. Why? That would induce them to go through sporulation or meiosis, right? And form tetrads. If you have this ascus that's holding together before haploid drives as spores, right? You can mechanically dissect that spore into, you can mechanically break the ascus wall. You can pick out the four spores and lay them out individually so they'll form pure colonies. Right? And then you can analyze the colonies and determine whether. Did I just derail? You didn't have to do, they weren't, right? The complementation, I'm sorry, I switched over to the lysine linkage experiment, I'm sorry. For the complementation experiment, you didn't have to learn about the meiosis, right? So the diploids were not put on nitrogen for that experiment, low nitrogen. They were simply tested at 37 degrees to see whether or not the diploids were, right? And again, if the mutations were recessive, if the strains had mutations in the same gene, at least for the sake of operation, let's just say if they had mutations in the same gene, then the diploid would not grow. But if they each had a recessive mutation in a different gene, then the diploid would be heterozygous for each of those, and therefore the diploid would grow it. Right? So you had a set of data that said which pairwise crosses failed to grow, diploids failed to grow, which ones could grow. So then how do you approach that? How do you get information out of that? I apologize for just dealing with a little bit of experiment.
So you mean the second question?
No. I don't know. I don't remember what order I gave you, but the complementation data.
Oh, the second question.
My understanding, right, so I guess I'm not understanding how to interpret the data. Alpha 1A1, if you look at it, it's negative. So that means that they had the mutation same genes and the diploids didn't grow?
Okay, let me just caution you, and I hate to do this, but because what you said is right, and that's the way most people look at it. I just want to warn you that this is only operationally suggesting that they're in the same gene. It doesn't prove they're in the same gene, but this is the first pass analysis to say, okay, which ones seem to be in the same gene. And we'll see why in a minute. We'll look at the complementation data more. We'll see why you can't exactly people doing the same gene. But you can conclude they're in the same complementation phase, which means that when you pairwise cross through the diploid, it is not able to grow. Right? So what I was hoping you would do is take that table and try to reorganize it and see how many genes there might be involved. See if you could tell which ones are recessive, which ones are dominant, how many complementation genes are there. Is there anything unexplained? Is it raising questions? Can anybody do that?
I found 9 or 10 genes total.
9 or 10 genes total. Ooh.
6, I found 5.
Okay, 5, 6, 9. Okay.
I can explain my 9 or 10.
I hope not.
Yes.
The reason I say this is because I don't believe there are 9 or 10. But okay, let me show you what I did with compensation day one and what you worked on. When you guys have a really big class. In the past, when I've taught this class, it's been 5 or 6 students, so I've let them go to their board and work on it. But I think if there's some of you who have 5 and some of you have 9, maybe you better just go straight to the analysis. And then we'll come back and figure out why everybody has it. All right. So what I tried to do is reorganize it so it would be obvious for the confrontation itself. My presenting that you guys did to me. And so there's 2 units that I didn't put on this table, which were
alpha 5 and A6.
One of them was
dominant negative one.
They had a TSU, and when you crossed it to the wild type, which clearly had the wild type allele of the gene that mutated to cause the TSU, that diploid still had the phenotype that meant that even though you had a wild type gene, the mutant gene dominated, so it was a dominant mutation.
Right?
I don't
think they're nervous
to give me. So I'll come back to that later. We talked about that a little bit last time. Does anybody remember? What is this?
Can we find out? I don't know.
You can combine your genetics class with an aerobics class. We talked a little bit about how you would know whether the TS phenotype is attributable to a single mutation or whether it required multiple mutations, right? Do you remember? Right. So we said if you backcrossed it to wild type and there was a single gene segregated, a single mutant gene and a wild type counterpart, then every single tetrad that came out of that cross, 2 of the spores would have the TS phenotype and 2 of the spores would be wild type. Because that's a single gene segregated between the 2 during meiosis. Right? But if you needed 2 mutations and they were not linked to have the TS phenotype, those 2 genes would segregate independently. And if we'll go back and look at that data in a minute, and I'll put the screen back up and I can show you on the board. But if you think about it, just the probability of, in every tetrad, the probability of the same 2 spores inheriting the same 2 mutations, if they're segregating independently, is 0. You look at enough tetrads. In fact, you expect to see only 1/4 of all the tetrads will have 2 TS and 2 non-TS if it requires 2 mutations. Half of them will get 1 of the mutant genes, but not the other, but those won't be TS. And the other 1/4 will get both of the wild type genes and the mutant genes. Right. So that's the power of genetic analysis, the power of linkage analysis that you can do in use, because you can look at the parts of the the separate myotic events, you can look at it and the spores of other genetic analysis. You can't do that with other systems where you don't have that ascus coming together, the parts of the cylinder. You can't tell how spores are related to each other, so you can't ask how this aggregate relative to each other. Okay, so let's assume that you've done that and you know that it's a single gene mutation. And you have good evidence, at least for some of these, that it's a single gene mutation, because if it required 2 mutations to have a human mutant phenotype, those are hard and rare to get, right? You have to have, mutation is usually the general frequency for what rate you would get a TS mutation in a gene is something like 10 to the minus 9th or so, 1 in 10 to the 9th. Colonies that have a TS mutation, probably even a little bit lower than, probably have any mutation in your genes about 1 in 10 to the 9th. If you want to get a TS mutation, you lower than that. So the probability of getting 2 of those events in the same cell is pretty low. Certainly the probability of getting them twice independently so that when you pairwise cross, they fail to complement each other is, once you see them start to form the complementation, that's pretty good evidence that you're looking at single gene mutations. Does that make sense to you? Alright, but does this make sense to everybody? How we organize this?
Yes.
Okay, so we've all said that there were 2 genes that were, 2 mutants that were dominant. How many genes were there?
one or two.
At least one, right? But we don't know if those two dominant mutants have any interference in the gene. There was at least one here. Okay. And now when we look at the complementation table, how many more do we see evidence for?
Seven or eight.
Is everybody agreeing with three or four? This looks like a pretty well behaved complementation group that's probably defining one gene. So now we've got at least two, right? This is a pretty good complementation group as far as we can tell. So let's say there's probably three. This is a little bit more complicated, right? No, it's not really clear what's going on there, is it? If this were a minus, we'd say, sure, that looks like it's a gene. But the fact that this is a plus and this is a minus makes it difficult to know exactly what's going on there. And this is where, this is, I put this in because this is an example of the point I made before, which is complementation, which is population suggests that every gene is in the same gene. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment. Okay, so I'm seeing there could be as few as four, perhaps as many as, if the two dominant ones are the same. You might get to nine. The thing is, once you see this funny stuff going on, which we'll talk about in a minute, then you actually have to keep an open mind that any of these could have been joined the same thing if you had more mutants, right? Does that make sense? Okay, so let's say you got to this point. So we found several genes. What are the conclusions?
The mutation in A1 and A4 are linked.
Mutation in A1
and A4 are linked.
Did you say they're linked or did you say they're in the same gene?
They're in the same gene.
They're in the same complementation. Okay. Right, so I think the point you're making is we need to find out. Okay, so but it's still you it looks like you kept screening, you're likely to find more mutants. You're not finding all the mutants are in the same gene, sure. So there seem to be multiple genes that can lead you to get things right. Yes, because you're finding a TS. There would be many genes that can lead you to get TS. But if you had some secondary genotype, like a small butter rest, you would be talking about some subset of the TS means, then you might wonder how many genes can you take actually get that phenotype. And the conclusion so far would be that there's probably seven. Okay, so then what would you want to do?
The alpha 7, the last one.
Yeah, we're going to come back and spend more time talking about this complementation in a minute. Okay. Hopefully you've given some thought to what might cause it kind of damage.
I think what was a good thing about the table, because I came across this
knowing the word, and it has a lot, it has like 15 vertical videos. So how is the, is there any technique to determine the complementation other than your organizing
tool? I think reorganizing is the best way to try to get everything to fall out. I mean, you can just start making a list that, you know, you can say, okay, looking for the minuses instead of, like, if you just take the table before you reorganize it, instead of the alpha one, what you can put the complement and write everything down, and then start with alpha two, write itself on the complement, and then they would cluster that way. But I find it easier to reorganize it. It's a huge complementation to it. What would you do next? Is why does alpha 7 complement the A5 mutant and not the A2 mutant when alpha 6 fails to complement both, essentially, right? So you would have predicted from here that this was going to be a minus, right? Or you would have predicted from here that this was going to be a plus. And actually, this could have been a plus, or this is a plus. Any one of those things would have made those complements, right? If this had been a minus, it would seem straightforward that this is these four genes all have mutations in the same gene. If this had been a plus, we'd say, okay, these are not in complementation, these three genes are in complementation. So like this is done flush and it's like these two are in complementation, these two are in complementation. So, right? So basically you're trying to figure out, is this a plus this gene? Because these really do have mutations in this gene. Or is one of these minuses this gene? Because for some reason these don't have mutations in the same gene, and they're really just like as a TSC. Can you think of anything you've ever heard of that explains this? Let's say that you really do have any questions in this community.
Might be a leaky mutation.
Right, but if it were leaky, why would they individually have the same type of thing as this one that only can be created? You're not, you could be right. I mean, for example, you could invoke, I'm not sure that this actually happens, but if you imagine it, let's assume that for some reason, so you have a mutation in a protein that is required, let's say, 37 genes, it's not required 26. So when you shift the cell to 37, the protein is absent both at 26 and 37, but it's only required at 37, so the cell is not required at 37. Imagine that protein is more important for haploids to go into diploid genes. So the leaky mutant may be diploid because it doesn't require that protein. It's a haploid specific function, so you wouldn't have any difference. So I mean, that's a model that could work. I'm not aware of it in a situation where that's actually the case where protein is less required in the diploid than in the haploid. That's a model. That's the flip side of what we're going to talk about. Can you think of any other? Yes.
The mutation doesn't have to be the same mutation, so it could cause a lot of change.
Okay, so what you're suggesting is what we refer to as intra-allelic complementation. And here's the key. What you're saying is that these two mutants have mutations in the same gene, but they're affecting the gene differently, and such that if you have both of the mutant proteins together, you can get that function, right? Where you commonly see this is if, and this is not an unusual phenomenon, it's very common, not real common, maybe more than 100 years or so, maybe less than 90 years, something here, it happens, but what it generally means is that you're looking at a multifunctional protein. So a good example of that is if enzymes are involved in fatty acid synthesis, there are four different enzymatic activities in one polypeptide. Okay. And so just for the sake of argument, imagine you have a protein that has four different domains in it. And every one of these domains is essential to make fatty acids. So if you have a mutation, let's say, in this domain in the mutant, one of the mutants, it can't make fatty acids at high temperature because it doesn't have this enzymatic activity in the body. But if another mutant, for example, has a cancer in another function within the polyfunctional protein, let's say in the D domain of the protein, happens with this gene also wouldn't be functional because it doesn't have any D activity. But if you had a diploid that had both of these mutant genes in it, and the protein folded up okay, this would be lacking A, but this would be fine with that A. Right? This gene would be lacking, this protein would be lacking the activity that's required D activity. But this gene would have, okay? So you're in a situation where these two genes are in the same gene, these two mutations are in the same gene. But they're complementing each other in the and that's called interallelic communication. So that's one possibility, is that in fact all four of these mutants have mutations in the same gene, but these other mutants are, let's say, a nonsense mutation. So you get no functional protein at all. And that's a difference. Okay. So they have mutations, TS mutations in the same functional activity. So when you make the diploid, you have to store that essential function. Does that make sense? I can explain again. So what, I'm trying to think of another example. You just want to go through this one again?
Explain this exactly.
Okay, so you have, this is a common thing you see when you have multifunctional proteins. And each of the the domains of the protein encodes an essential function. So you get a mutation in a domain in one of the mutants that destroys the activity in one of the essential functions of the protein. But in another mutant, you have a mutation in a different domain of the protein that destroys a different essential function of the same protein. So when you make the diploid, you're getting one of the functions from one of from the gene that is not defective in that function, whereas in the from this is the diploid. Okay. So we're saying if this function is gone in one mutant and this function is gone in the other, when you make the diploid, you restore both of the functions, even though independently this one will be able to make a function of say fatty acid because it doesn't have this domain, or this one doesn't have this one. Okay. But then you have to say, well, why are all these feeling complementary? And the reason for that is that those mutants are not leaving a partially functional protein, they're destroying the function altogether. So when you pairwise cross them, at least one of them is. Or they're destroying the same function, so when you get the diploid, you're not going to get that activity. Or they're destroying all the functions, so when you get the diploid, you don't get that protein. Okay. So when you see that kind of behavior, you would start thinking, gee, maybe there's an enzyme or a protein involved in the process of mucus that doesn't have the functions. That's interesting thing to think about.
So that's one question.
Let's think about the other possibility, and then we'll just decide how we could just cover it.
The mutation is such that it's structurally temperature sensitive, not functional. And so I need to say, like, during the furnace temperature, when the protein falls, the protein can be functional. Temperature, but if
you're raising a different, I think, issue. That was so bizarre. Just as I stepped, it made that noise. What you're talking about is really not the same thing, because it doesn't really matter. In this case, it doesn't matter if the protein is temperature sensitive for synthesis or temperature sensitive for function. Either way, when you shift the cells to high temperature, if it's an essential function, eventually you're not going to have functional protein. That's a little bit of a digression, though. It's an interesting thing to think about, too. So it's true when you look at a temperature-sensitive mutant, there's two classes of temperature-sensitive mutants. They can be temperature-sensitive for synthesis, and they can be temperature-sensitive for function. If they're temperature-sensitive for function, that means all the pre-existing protein, when you shift the cells to 37 degrees, won't be functional. And so the cells won't exhibit a TS phenotype until they've degraded or lost or had to turn over all that mutant protein and make new. And with some lag, eventually, they'll start to show a TS phenotype because they can't make functional protein at the high temperature, but the protein that's pre-existing when you shift it to the high temperature is functional. A mutation that would exhibit its phenotype much more rapidly would be a mutation that's temperature sensitive for function. So as soon as you shift it to 37 degrees, the protein is no longer functional. So it's not like you have to only turn over the mutants. The mutation not only affecting mutants and synthesized proteins, affecting existing proteins. Okay. But that wouldn't affect this phenotype, because this phenotype is after several days you're asking the TS. So what's the other? So intra. So does this term make sense to you? Intra allelic complementation. Intra means within the same, right? So it's two different alleles of the same gene. So it's intra allelic complementation. So they have mutations in the same gene and yet they're complementing each other. So we call that intra allelic complementation. No, it's not a suppressor mutation because they're complementing each other. They're not suppressing each other. A suppressor means that one mutation corrects the other. This mutation in B is not correcting the mutation in A. It's just complementing. Okay. All right. So let's say that. Thank you.
should have been plus. So does that mean about A5 and alpha 6? They have mutations in the same gene or different genes? If it should have been a plus, but it had mutations in the same gene. So it's acting like they had mutations in the same gene, but we're suggesting maybe this is the one that's missing, which is maybe they actually have mutations in a different gene, even though they're failing to complement. Okay, so that's the other way you can get this kind of funny business of complementation. And that arises from a phenomenon called unlinked, referring to the fact that they're in different genes, but non-complementation, meaning they're nonetheless failing to complement each other, even though they're different genes. So again, intra-allele complementation means they're in the same gene, and yet they are able to complement each other. Unlinked non-complementation means they're in different genes, and yet they fail to complement each other. And this is something that Rock kind of alluded to here in a different way, but this normally occurs when you have a situation where you actually need more of the function in the diploid than you do now. And this is fairly common for a lot of polymeric proteins, like tubulin and actin and so forth. Okay. And so, where this has been observed, one example is in Saccharomyces boulardii, there are two tubulin genes, called FABA and FABB. So the two functions were done in these, and both are called tubulin. But in the itself, a mutation in either gene can give you a gene. You can get TS mutations in your gene, you have B gene, and you get TS mutations in your gene. If you back plus this, let's see, have a TS mutation in the gene. If you back cross it to a wild type, so that in the wild type, in the diploid, you have two cross copies of the wild type type A gene, so that way only that mutation in the gene. And then the diploid would be heterozygous for the TS mutation. So in the diploid, you have two wild type A's and one wild type B, and that's not TS. We're going to complete that because we were tested to see what was so what that tells you is only you have three tub genes, they're not TS. But if you cut that part, if you cross it to a 2% limitation of A, so this is crossing to wild type, this is crossing to tub A TS. Then what you're going to have, the tub B TS is going to give you one wild type tub A. And if you cross this tub B mutant, you're going to get one tub B TS mutant and one tub B wild. And now in this diploid, you've got two wild type tubulin genes and two TS mutants. And that actually could be given to the TS phenotype because maybe the situation within the diploid, you actually need at least three copies of the tub genes to have enough chicken. Okay? So when you see this unlinked non-complementation, invariably it is telling you that you have mutations in two functionally redundant genes, and that if you're heterozygous for each of them in the diploid, you're going to have two. Okay. So again, these genes are encoding functionally redundant proteins, but they're not the same genes. They're not even on the same chromosome because they know they're segregated independently, but they both encode the same type of a protein, very similar protein. And in the diploid cell, you need at least three wild type alleles. So you back cross it to a wild type, you've got two A's and one B wild type. And that's sufficient to you, so you won't have the TS phenotype. But if you pairwise cross two TS alleles, one in the B gene and one in the A gene, then you've got a diploid that only has two wild type alleles, a wild type sub A and a wild type sub B. And that doesn't give you enough to do. You have to go out for this. Like there's no TS
So that would explain how you get a minus when you get that when you get into a different term. So these are two kinds of phenomena that make us have to be very cautious about seeing complementations of data that you can do. Because in this case, you would have pushed more genes than there were lots, because they're failing to complement each other with another in the same gene. And in this case, you're going to conclude there are fewer genes in fact you are, because they're failing to complement each other with another in the same gene. Okay, we're showing you here a real complement function, and you back cross each of them to qualify. You still would expect to see 2 to 3 PS in the body from the rows as well. Like they were showing unlinked non-complement function, you back cross the root thing in the wild type. Same thing, you have 1 PS allele, and you're going to have to apply to PS phenotype. So you back cross with the wild type, again, you're going to get 2 to 3 PS. So that's really just a test whether it's a single gene mutation or not, causing the test. But you're on the right track. Don't backcross it for a while, right?
Would you have to use more?
How about if you take this diploid itself? What do you predict would happen in this case? If these have mutations in the same gene that they can complement, if you took this diploid and let it go through meiosis and look at the policy versus what we could predict, think about this. If you took this diploid, and the two scores that with this A minus mutation, you're going to be TS. And the two scores that with this B minus mutation, you're going to be TS. So if these are showing intra-allele complementation, you would take this diploid and do diploid analysis, you're going to find that all four products of analysis. Because they have mutations in the same gene. If in fact these have mutations in different genes, that's different in meiosis.
There should be 3 temperature sensitive mutations.
If they have mutations in other genes, let's say you have a diploid now that has confusing to use the A and B systems for the polyfunctional protein, let's call it X. You have a mutation X, TY, TS mutation X. The test wears more than a very different. So when you make your diploid, it's going to get a lot of X. So that is going to score X is going to go through, right? So you're going to get
two isomers in your in TSO with X, the two that you learned a lot of the derivatives. But if Y is leaving independently, then so you understand what this represents. So we're saying, okay, let's say that, that X is going TS, TS, plus, plus. And then independently, Y is going to be. And this tetrad is going to be plus, plus, TS, TS. This tetrad is plus, TS, plus, TS. TS, plus, TS, plus. TS, TS, plus, plus. Okay? So this tetrad, now we have, you have four representing voice miles, okay? Because this four is going to be TS because you've got the X TS mutation. XTS mutation, YTS mutation, YTS mutation, and therefore all four parts of the edges are going to be T. Right? And this tetrad, this is going to be TS because you get TXTS. This is going to be TS because you get both TSs. This is going to be, this is going to be one because it's not going to be TS. Right? So this is going to be TS. So this tetrad is going to be TS and one Y. The same thing with this tetrad. One lock it because TS, 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 but this four gets you off the TS. And this one's actually going to, because the two spores have got the XTS, also got the YTS, you're going to have two wild cards and two spores. It's a very different outcome if they're in different genes and if they're in the same gene. They're in the same gene, every single part of the is going to be 2S. If they're in different genes, 25% is going to be 4TS. 25% of the is going to be 4TS or synthesis. Half of it is going to be 3TS and 1 non-TS. And 25% are going to be 2 wild types and 2TS. So the important thing is, if they're in different genes, you're going to uncover the loss of phenotype again among the polysynthesis. Because it's possible that in the same gene, some of the spores get both of the wild type genes. But if they're in the same gene, it's just not possible for each cell to get the spore gets the wild type gene. Because there's four of the same genes. That makes sense? So again, if you were to take this diploid and dissect it, you got four TS products of meiosis. That's the claim this is showing intra allele complementation, meaning that you only have mutations in the same gene. If you get this pattern tetrads, as opposed to the TS mutation, this would be an indication that they're actually in different genes and that this is a more complementation between two different genes. You know, if what you're seeing is unwanted wrong complementation, then basic tetrads are going to be used. It's unwanted wrong complementation. So let's look at this and call what we have. So tab A and tab B. So in the diploid, we're going to have the diploid thing, the heterozygous fermentation, the A locus heterozygous fermentation for protecting this, right? Again, they segregate independently, they have separate genes. And so, again, you can get, you know, I'm just using the plus and TS because of the A. So if you're seeing unlinked long representation, as opposed to real real failure complement, okay, which would be at all four products in terms of ATS. Real failure complement is in the same gene that we have all four products in terms of ATS. But again, if you look in this, you're going to find the same genes in terms of ATS. So if you're really seeing intra-real complementation, you're going to see all four products in terms of ATS. if what you're in fact seeing in the minus is giving you only one complementation. So instead of seeing all four parts in BTS, again, you're going to start to see all four coming back because they really aren't using the same unit. Any questions about that? So what we've done so far is, you know, how you get the mutants, how you test whether or not they're dominant or recessive, how you put them into complementation groups, how you can get information about the mutant screen from the complementation groups, how you can also get even additional information if you get these complementation groups that are not straightforward, because they can give you an indication that you either have this phenomenon of unlinked non-complementation, which can tell you that there are functionally redundant proteins involved in the process you're studying. Or alternatively, that you're seeing intra-allelic complementation, which can be an indication that you have multifunctional proteins involved in the process. So you get extra information, but the reason you want to do the analysis, the linear analysis and so forth, is you want to know how many genes are really in this group. Do I want to start looking for the wild type gene that complements? How do I know how many genes are really here? Right? By the way, these, you can actually set up screens to specifically look for unlinked non-complementation. So if you want to find out if there is a functional non-complementation, you can actually, in fact, that's what the main human genes were found. Many years ago, when people first started looking for mutants and set us down to the mutants, they had a genome of mutants, and they wanted to see what might be right-shaming non-complementation did, because it was specifically set out for that to screen one and then non-complementation, and saw the bump of the genome of mutants. So it can be a powerful tool to find these functional event proteins or multiple proteins. So the next thing that you want to do then is zoom. Well, let's ask one more question. We have the issue of the dominant mutations. We have the two dominant mutations, right? We want to know if they're in the same proteins. Do you have a way to think of how to do that? This is it. Mutation that causes 10% of the genes to get dominant. This is where you should think of yourself, well, she's talking about linking analysis, it's a powerful way all the time, so maybe it's linked to analysis. Do you think of whether or not, do you think that if you took, if you pairwise, a diploid that came from pairwise crossing the two dominant mutations, the A and the alpha, what would happen if you looked at the meiosis? If the two dominant TS mutations are in the same gene, what would you predict would happen? All four parts of meiosis from that diploid would be TS, and that would tell you that those two dominant mutants had mutations in the same gene. Conversely, if they were in different genes, the TS phenotypes to say it independently. And just like you see here, you can start to uncover some parts of meiosis that are well. Because if they're heterozygous for those two TS mutants, some of these scores are going to be in here, both wild type propositions. Anything? So again, the linking analysis can be really powerful. Figuring out whether the mutations are the same gene with different genes or the dominant mutations are the same with different genes. Sometimes dominant mutations are very interesting in terms of depending on what you're trying to do. Because remember, dominant mutations in general tend to reflect a gain of function of protein rather than a loss of function. Right? That means even though the wild type protein is there, the mutant protein is still exerting its negative phenotype. So often it means it can interrupt the process. And so sometimes the dominant mutations are the more interesting ones in terms of getting a handle on the process you're trying to study. So while they're harder to work with in the sense that you can't do complementation analysis with them, you may still be very interested in trying to figure out how many genes mutate to cause a dominant mutant. And you can get to the wild type genes, it's a little bit trickier. We'll come back to that in a minute. So what I want to do now is actually go through the homework problem on the linkage. And then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and figure it out and get to the law of mutants. We found mutants with more complementation to it. Okay, so how did you do with the linkage journals?
Are you going to
figure out how far apart these two genes are?
16, 5, 6, 7, 17
items. Okay, and how did you get that? Anybody willing to go on the board and tell us how they got that?
I guess so. Oh.
That wasn't like that from principal windows.
Okay. Should I show all of my work?
Well, how long will it take?
It could take 6 minutes.
6 minutes? How? Okay. Let's start with this, okay? Let's start this. Let's take a vote. How many people? No. We're not going to take a vote. So tetrad one on the table. What kind of tetrad did you decide that was?
Parental.
How many people can you say parental about? For those of you who don't have an opinion, it's because you didn't do it right here. So if you're not going to be confused, you can do it. Okay. So you're not arguing that it's not a opinion, you just don't know. Okay. The tetrad number two.
Tetrad.
How many people think it was a tetrad? Three.
Parental tetrad.
Four.
Parental tetrad.
Four is PV.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
I would have done one, but you're right. Okay. Five.
Tetra type.
Six.
Rental data.
Seven. Okay, so you don't have any trouble telling what tetra types and rental data are, most of them, okay? Okay, so assume that they already got that right. And how many rental data types do we have?
So there were eight.
Eight PDs and four NPDs?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And zero NPDs.
Okay, so we have eight PDs, four PDs, and zero NPDs. Okay, now it should take you 1 minute to show us how you get the distance between them.
Okay, I can just put this up. Yeah, but I just. Well, anyways. Isn't it more interesting to show for people who didn't understand it how those numbers came out as a rather than the equation, which anyone can do math?
Okay. Yes, that's true, but I think maybe the people who don't understand it should come and find me and we should look through it, okay? How to tell what's a PD, what's a D, okay? Because I don't know where they're at. Okay. So you're saying you don't want to do the math.
Okay, I'll do it. I'll do it.
So do you also want me to show the equation?
Just do you want me to show you what I want you to show? They're used interchangeably, but okay, so tetrad analysis really simply means letting it go through meiosis and getting the four products in meiosis. So that's the process of doing tetrad analysis. Linkage analysis means analyzing the four products in meiosis and determining how much tissue is between them. Okay.
So when we were talking just previously about like that investing, that was more tetrad analysis than linkage analysis. Because we were looking at the phenotypes.
Doing this?
Well, we were looking at the phenotypes. Because you said it was linkage analysis.
Yeah, okay. Okay, I understand your question. So you're asking, can you, what I call this process of figuring out what the spores are that are coming out of, would I call that linkage analysis or would I call it testing?
Yeah.
I do use it to do this testing analysis. The linkage analysis could be actually determining the linkage analysis. But this is not a quantitative linkage analysis, but it's asking whether or not the two genes are linked. So I think I use an interchange that I think people can maybe linkage really should be a good quantitative to help our part of the genes. Okay, all right, thank you. So this is how we get 16 centimorgans. Did anybody go to the set website to try to find out more about these? How far apart they really were? Did you go to the set in the database or
what? But I didn't play with these, I just played with it.
Okay. I really want you to go to that website because there's a tremendous amount of information, okay? For example, if you were to go to that website, you say, okay, well, now I know there's some 16 centimorgans between these two genes. So what kind of a sensitive distance is that? Remember, there's a whole genome is in the sequence. I think you actually know to find the splice 2 gene and the set 18 gene. You can find it physically exactly how far apart they are. How many genes are between them? You get a feeling for the 16 centimorgan gene. So if you were to do that, if I'd done that, you went to the Saccharomyces genome database and you, there's a box and you're going to click on the gene names. If you just typed in lice 2, it would have come up with a lot of information. There's all kinds of different types of genes. One of them is the genome map. It will tell you that lice 2 is also known as YBR195 C, which means a lot to a number of genes. Okay. So the chromosomes, there are 16 chromosomes in these. They're not, the chromosome 1 is their letter, A through whatever it is, A. Okay. And so YBR means to me, these chromosome 2 right arm. And 115 means 115 gene starting from the centromere on the right arm. Okay? And if you were to look at set 18, it's called YBR080C. So it is, this is 115. Starting at the centromere and going on the right arm, you go up. This is gene 115. And this one is gene 80. That tells you what? 25 genes between the two? From 80 to 115. Okay. So these two genes are separated by 25 other genes. And you can even find out that, actually, I don't remember how the number goes, but you can find the precise number and how far apart they are. So they're actually 58,850 base pairs from the end of one to the beginning of the other. Okay. That's how far apart they are. Let's say almost 60,000 base pairs apart. And if that's 25 genes, then the calculation is about 2,000 base pairs per gene, now we call gene, in use. 25 times 2,000, a little more than that, it's going to be 50,000. And so that means the 16 centimorgans correspond to, in real physical distance, about 60,000. So this is a measure of 1% recombination between the two genes. So in an interval of about 60,000 base pairs, we get about 1% recombination analysis. You can imagine the significance of the each gene database. If you look at all this historical interesting, there's a lot of information about what the base crossovers are on chromosome, how much it varies from one particular location in these ones. So why don't we take a break and then we'll come back to our meeting collection and start thinking about how we get our hands on the game. Okay. that's just certain. So we already alluded to the fact that the way you're going to, now that you have the mutations, what you really want to know is what mutated the cause phenotype and what's the function of the encoded protein. That's what you're really wanting to know. You're interested in sending some process. In the hypothetical case, we started with the cell division cycle, like to find out what proteins are controlling whether or not the cell progresses through the cell cycle, right? And so, again, the way you can do this is what's called cloning by complementation. I'm sure you've talked about that already. We talked about that earlier. This is cloning genes by complementation, because if there's a mutation and you have a library of wild type DNA, one of the plasmids in the library contains the wild type coding part of the gene that mutated. If the cells pick up the plasmid that's carrying that, then it will be expressed in that complement. So let me just a little bit about the design of the genomic library. You may remember what I told you in the beginning last week, that very few genes, only a small percentage of these genes, have introns. Okay, so this is important for library design because, number one, the problems in mammalian genes, if you're trying to clone them by function, is that they have introns. And so if you just took genomic DNA and cut it up, the chance of getting a functional protein, especially if you're putting it into yeast, like when you splice mammalian introns out, it creates problems. You have to start with a cDNA level. You have to start with messenger RNAs, because that's called DNA copies, and then so that you know that you actually have a coding sequence of the gene. But that's really not necessary in certain research, because such a small percentage of genes have introns. If they do have introns, they don't really have one. But then you're going back into yeast, so it's less than one out of here. Happen to have a gene in an So, splice it out of the DNA. So, but basically, the things to keep in mind are the size of the yeast phenome is 2 times 10 to the 6. Okay? And I just was talking a little bit about the distance between the 10% 18 and the lysis to gene, saying that there's the average size of the gene in the second lysis is 2,000 base pairs. Actually, the average size of the protein, I think, is 40,000 molecular weight, weights, so let's say about 400 amino acids. It takes about 1,200 nucleotides to encode a 40,000 molecular weight protein. And so if you add some 5' untranslated and 3' untranslated region, as well as some intergenic regions and DNA between genes, you end up with about 2,000 base pairs per gene. That's the average size gene. Your gene of interest could be huge. It could be tiny, right? It can range anywhere from. There are some genes that are less than 100 amino acids, so that's including the nucleotides that are functional and co-functional proteins or functional RNA. And then, like, I think in certain cases, large genes maybe somewhere around 100,000 molecular weight, maybe a little bit bigger than that. And those, of course, are much larger genes. So these are things to keep in mind when you're thinking about how you design a library, because you want to ensure that each fragment of DNA that are large enough, that there's a reasonable chance that the gene could catch you beyond the DNA. And it's only going to function if you put it on a plasmid and stick it in your cells. It's only going to function if the entire gene is there in the plasmid, right? On the other hand, you don't want it to be so huge that if it does complement, you have a big detective job to figure out which part of the DNA that is in the plasmid complement, right? So in yeast, most of the time, people aim for about 10,000 base pair inserts. So most of the libraries have somewhere around 5 to 10,000 base pair inserts. With the average gene size of about 2,000, that means we would have somewhere around 5 genes per plasmid. So you're going to fragment the yeast genome into average size fragments of about 10 to 4 base pairs. And then clone those into the selectable plasmid. So this is just yeast genomic DNA insert. With 10 to the 4th base pairs per plasmid, base pairs of genomic DNA per plasmid, and 2 times 10 to the 7th base pairs of the genome, that means you need somewhere around 2 times 10 to the 3rd transformers if every cell picked up an individual plasmid, right? to have coverage. But you really want at least 20 times higher than that, so you have a reasonable chance of getting UV damage in the sink. So just thinking about the design of the experiment, that's kind of a lot where you transform it into a mutant interest. You really want to screen somewhere around 2 times 10 to the 5th individual transformers. You have a reasonable chance of finding a transformer that acquired a plasmid that's going to allow your mutant to grow.
What were the 2 times 10, what was 2 times 10 to the 3 for again?
Well, if you had 10 to the 4th base pairs for plasmid, and 2 times 10 to the 7th base pairs for genome, then if every cell, if every plasmid is a different plasmid, it would take about 2,000 plasmids, like 10 to the 4th base pairs per plasmid, to get 2 times 10 to the 7th base pairs in the genome. But of course, when you transform the library into the cells, every cell's not going to get a different plasmid, so you want to get at least 20 times coverage.
Fragmented.
Traditionally, the approach has been used. Of course, you would restrict your entitlement commonly, you would have entitlement restriction anymore. And remember, a 6 base pair cutter an enzyme that recognizes a 60 base pair sequence is going to cut on average about every 20 minutes. About 1 in 4,000, right? 1 in 60, 4 to 6,000. Okay. You're 40 nucleotides, and you need 6 atoms to work. Okay. So about 1 in 4,000 is. So if you want to use a 6 base pair, let's say you bar 1 and you can use it. That site randomly is going to be about 1 in 4,000 base pairs. Okay. You don't really want to use something like that that gives you a complete digest to give you about the right size fragment. It's actually too small. You can do a partial digest. So you use a level of the enzyme so you're not getting complete digestion. You really don't want to do that with because the probability of there being that restrictions of being in your gene, or if it is in your gene, the probability of you recovering your gene is not high. Right? So let's say you were going to do this with EcoR1, and you were going to cut with EcoR1, so your average size fragments are about 8,000 base pairs. Well, if you were unlucky and your gene had several R1 sites in it, you would never find your gene in that plasmid library. So what people tend to do is cut with a 4 base pair cutter. A common one that's used is SAMPA. These sites are present about 1 in 256 base pairs, but you use a level of condition where you're getting an average size of 10,000 base pair fragments, and you're using, you just set up several trial digests. And then run Arbor's gel and look for the conditions where the average size fragment is about 10,000 base pairs on Arbor's gel. And those are the conditions you use. And that, because you're doing such a limited partial digest, then the chances of cutting the imaging becomes lower because even though these sites are fairly frequent, if you're only hitting 1 in, so if you're going to hit 10,000 base pairs, you're only hitting 1 in 20 in the south and east. Okay. All right, so that's something to think about in terms of designing the library. Libraries are pretty available right now, particularly many libraries, which isn't yet a library. You also have to think about what kind of a library you want to use. What kind of, there's 2 general considerations, and you probably want to make at this point. One is, do you want to use a single copy library, or do you want to use a high copy? And there's pros and cons to each of those decisions. But the nice thing about CRB studies, because has been so well studied, is we know exactly what the sampling is look like in CRB studies. So there are a set of plasmids. Thank you. there's three different types of flagging that are being used in these, and come back to integrating that for a minute. There's some generic plasmids, and so these plasmids actually have an element of DNA, a fragment of DNA that's a centromere sequence. What that does is to ensure that they'll segregate faithfully at the daughter cells. So just like a chromosome, they're maintained at about one copy per cell. And if they have an origin of replication, this is what this part is going to autonomously replicate the sequence. So this is when they synthesis can initiate. So, and that they replicate one cell division, and then the two daughter plasmids are faithfully segregated to the mother and daughter cell. So they're maintained at a low single copy, very similar to a chromosome. These plasmids are all shuttle plasmids, which means that they also have a bacterial replication origin and a selectable marker for bacteria, usually ampicillin, chromosome as well. And the importance of that is you can shuttle these plasmids back and forth between the chromosomes. So often you want to do the amplification and library construction and everything in bacteria, and then you purify the plasmid from E. coli to transform it into these bacteria to grow faster. It's easier to purify plasmid DNA from E. coli than it is from these because it's and so anyway, so the centromere plasmids that are maintained a low copy number, they're pretty close to a chromosomal element. But the replicating plasmids don't have a centromere on them. We have another element, which this is not really it. There are plasmids that have what's called the 2-micron origin of replication, and that's an extremely efficient origin of replication. So they replicate many times per cell cycle. So they're maintained at a high copy number, more than 25 copies. So you have the option of either using a centromeric plasmid, which would be a low copy number plasmid, or high copy number plasmid. But so what do you see as being relative advantages in those two high copy numbers?
The experiment will take less time with low copy.
Yeah.
Less data to look at.
I don't think it'll. Okay, so what? Okay, so I'm not sure exactly what it means, but let me explain what I think the consideration is, and then you can tell me what you think about it. So a low copy plasmid, if you really just want to get the wild type gene complemented, right, the chances of getting it may be higher if you go with a low copy plasmid than a high copy. Because with a high copy plasmid, if there's anything else that can compensate for your mutant gene, but it happens only in high copy, then you may find it. That could be interesting, okay? So you might want to do a high copy suppressor. This is a suppressor screen now. Because what I'm saying is, you may end up getting things that complement your mutant that are not the wild type only of your gene, because there are other things that in high copy can bypass the requirement for your mutant gene. So for example, if you had a TS mutant in a protein that caused the protein to be unstable, but you had another protein that it interacts with, and just by mass action, if you had more of that other binding protein, you might be able to shift the equilibrium so more of the protein is in the bound state and therefore stabilize even though it has the mutation. That means the gene you get in your complementation component is not actually going to be the wild type gene, it's going to be a high copy suppressor gene. You might want that. But anyway, it's something to think about. So most of the time, if you're just trying to get to the wild type gene, most people would start with a centromeric plasmid. On the assumption, knowing that it's a recessive mutation, you already know if there's one wild type and one mutant copy, it's going to suppress. It's going to complement the gene. Question, because I prefer to use complement when we mean it actually gets the wild type gene that restores function, and suppress to mean it uses some other gene besides the wild type gene, some non-allelic gene that suppresses the phenotype. Okay, we'll talk more about that when we start talking about suppressor screens and synthetic lethal screens next time. All right, so does everybody basically see what the difference is between the two? Okay, so since these centromeric plasmids they have a centromere, you simply transform your TS mutant with the Pleasant Library. Usually, and you'll see why, most of the time these libraries are marked with a marker called urethrin. Urethrin encodes an enzyme that's involved in urosal biosynthesis. And most of these strains that are used in the lab are urethrin mutations. So they're set up for selecting for plasmids that have a urethrin genome. So if this plasmid gets into a urethrin mutant, it'll complement these cells and will grow that urosal biosynthesis. So that will be your selection for getting that subset of cells that have actually been fit the plasmid. So it's a very straightforward experiment. You grow up your TS cells at constant temperature. You can actually make them competent to take up DNA very much like you do for bacteria. So bacteria use calcium chloride and makes the cells leak into DNA. You need to flip in acetate as a dead end compound to see the other cells. Actually take up the DNA. You then plate them on media lacking uracil, if your library is marked with a uromarker, and you'll get a fairly high frequency of transformation. Something on the order of maybe about 10 to the 4th transformers per microgram of added to plasma DNA. It's a fairly respectable transformation efficiency. For those who work with the coli, or is the energy less, but it's still very good. Okay, so now you probably would do your experiments that you're actually first selecting the permissive condition, in our case, low temperature, which is 26 degrees. And the reason you would do that, so you have two choices. You could go straight to the restrictive condition. So right out of incubating the cells with the plasma, you could plate the cells already selectively. The things that could go at 37 degrees. Or if you just transform the vector alone, you have no insertion expected by nothing going at 37. You could go straight to 37 degrees to select the things going to put the wild card gene, but the reason you might not want to do that is it takes a while for the gene to get expressed and start making the protein that's going to complement. Depending on how fast the cells die at 37, you might want to give them a chance to go permissively first, express the protein, and then shift into 37. Okay, and in this way, so then you replicate to 37, you're going to find a few cells, a few colonies, hopefully, that have picked up the wild type gene that complements your mutant. Now, from there, you've already discussed the possibility that what you're hoping to find is a wild-type copy of the gene that's mutant in the TS mutation. But what you really have to formally show are two things. First thing you have to do is be sure that the reason that this transformer is growing is because it acquired a plasmid, and not because it acquired a suppressor mutation on the chromosome when we voted the original mutation back to TS plus. So just because you've got something that's going in 37 doesn't prove that the reason it's going in 37 is because it acquired a plasmid. In fact, if you look at the control I just mentioned, which is in transforming the vector along with the two vectors and the plasmid, you probably will see some colonies coming in at 37. Because you will get suppressors when you get colonies. If you're truly about these are 37 cells, that will fix them. So, how would you prove that the reason that colony is growing at 37 is because it acquired a plasmid that has the complement gene? Okay, so let's assume whether it's a suppressor or not, yes, certainly would have to have the, if it doesn't have the urogene, then clearly it's not related to the plasmid. So you're on the right track. Okay. But you selected a monoshear, so everything that's going here is your plus. But that doesn't mean that everything that's going there has acquired a lot of gene. It could be acquired in a plasmid, it doesn't have a lot of gene. So if it uses the plasmid, will it revert back to the TS phenotype? If the TS complementation is linked to the plasmid, because the plasmid is carrying the gene that complements the TS mutation, then surrogates that have lost the plasmid will revert back to temperature sensitivity, right? Okay, so this is the significance of the Uro3 plasmid, because the Uro3 plasmid is actually called a counter-selectable plasmid. Do you know what that means? So the Uro3 gene I told you it's a gene that's involved, it encodes an enzyme that's involved in uracilsynthesis. And without getting into the details, that particular enzyme can take a compound called fluoroalkylic acid. It's a, it's a substrate analog of one of the substrates for one of the enzymes in uracil biosynthesis. So it binds to the enzyme, but because of the fluorine we find, it actually inactivates the enzyme, so it kills. But it will only do that if the URP gene is here, because the URP enzyme actually activates the compound to be a suicide compound. So the long and short of it is, if you take cells, URP plus, URP plasmid containing cells, cells that have URP plasmid in them, and you let them grow non-selective. So you put them on rich media, put them on media that has uracil in it, so that any cells that, so I told you that this is a centenary plasmid and it's faithfully segregated to the daughter cell. But because it's small and it's not in the chromosome, it's pretty good. But about 1 in 1,000 cell divisions, one of the cells doesn't get the plasmid. So at a frequency of about 10^-3, they get 0^-3. Of course, if you are on media where you require the URP gene to grow, those segments won't form colonies. There'll just be a cell that lost it, that cell won't be able to grow. So but if you grow them non-selectively, then those cells that have lost the plasmid will be there in the colony and they'll keep dividing because you don't need the URP gene to grow. And so you'll have some uracil segments in the colony. So you let them grow non-selectively. And then you plate on fluoroalkylic acid, and only those cells which have lost the URP gene can grow. So that's how you're going to find your plasmidless cells. So these are segments that have lost the plasmid. And if those things have become FOA resistant, URP minus, and now we go back to TS, temperature sensitivity, then you've demonstrated that in fact if you go back to the cells that are growing without uracil and then maintaining the plasmid, you have a plasmid in there that's responsible for complementing the TS. Okay.
Just to, like,
give you
the thing,
so the urethrine gene encodes an enzyme. You don't need to go to the details, but it encodes an enzyme that acts on FOA to make FOA co-receptor. So if you don't have urethrine around, the cells are fine. If you didn't have FOA fine, it's not FOA itself that stops the metabolite of FOA that's generated by the urethrine and encoded enzyme. Okay. So when you cells have the URP gene, they'll die in the FOA. So if you get things that can grow in the FOA, you really lost the URP gene. So that's the counter selection. That means counter selection means that when they kill cells, you get the die. So you select them for cells that are wrong.
The cells that
are
transforming, are they other biotypes in the cell?
They're your TS
mutant. Okay.
But you would have done your screen for TS mutants in a cell that you would have been anticipating that you wouldn't want to use a cell that you would.
Isn't there a possibility of
cause that you have a mutant? Yes, but if you actually cross a clearance, but if you cross a centimeter plasma into the chromosome, end up with a bicentric chromosome, that plasmid crosses onto the chromosome, it's taking a digital with it. So it's going into something that already has a sensitive. A dissensitive chromosome that goes and lost the cell you got. Okay, so basically, you don't see it again from something that plasmid into the chromosome.
What if it's the other?
The integrating plasma?
Yeah.
And that's one of them. The other thing that's saying that we have a plasmid is that we are rescued in terms of sensitivity. We still don't know if we've actually got the wild-type gene and we've got a dose dependent sequestration. And I alluded to that earlier and said that with high copy plasmids, you have relatively high risk of getting those risk because of this. I mean, they can be informative too. Again, you're saying is the wild type gene and is actually complementing, or it's a dose dependent suppressor that in extra coffee can suppress your mutant gene. But you'd like to know. So the rationale for working with the central plasma is you reduce the probability that you're going to get a dose dependent suppressor. But you don't eliminate it, because there are some cases where even just an extra copy or two of a gene that's not the wild type gene will give you a suppressor phenotype. So again, it's very easy to sort that out. We would want to do that. We would want, now that you have the plasmid, you want to prove that the plasmid is in fact carrying the wild type gene that was mutated in the strain and not suppressing through some other mechanism. Does everybody understand what we're going to try to sort out next time? Is it the wild type gene or is it a dose dependent suppressor? Dose dependent meaning, remember, the wild type cell, the TS mutants strain that you're starting with only has that TS mutant. You've already crossed it and proven that the only thing responsible for the TS phenotype is that single gene. So if it's not the wild type gene that's suppressing, it's a gene for which there's already a wild type copy in the genome. So we say it's a dose dependent because the wild type gene alone wasn't complementing because the starting strain is TS. So we're saying if we get a few extra copies of some other gene that was already there, wild type gene, that is suppressing. And so we refer to that as a dose-dependent suppressor. Okay? Because one copy wasn't enough. The cell had one copy to start with. Okay? So it needs extra dose. It could be one extra copy, could be seven. You've got a plasma, you know the plasma is responsible for the ability to go out 30 centigrade. So now you want to figure out, is it the wild type, let's say TS plus, really that complementation, or is it a dose dependent suppressor, which I just think is an EDS, dose dependent suppressor. The way that you can figure that out is, you can now take a gene that's, you know, earlier, which is that yeast has a very, very potent homologous recombination. So if you take a piece of yeast genomic DNA and you stick it into the yeast cell, the yeast will find the locus of that DNA to integrate the plasmid or fragment of DNA into that locus. Now, with the centromere plasmid that just came up, you can integrate a centromere plasmid into the chromosome network service. So for the same plasmids, you not select the things that integrate. But for the integrating plasmid, which I showed you earlier, we're going to talk about the integrating plasmid. They get abbreviated EX or recombinant plasmid. They have neither a replication origin. They have no origin of replication. So the only way they can be reproduced in the cell is if they integrate into the chromosome. So if you have a YIP plasmid that has a uromonkey on it, and you get stable transformers like you roll that uricin, you know that that plasmid is integrated into the chromosome. Because it can't replicate and it can't segregate by itself, so it's not going to be maintained in the body itself. So how is this helpful in sorting out whether you have the wild type gene and the dose dependent suppressor? So once you have the clone gene, you can use the genomic insert, the fragment of yeast genomic DNA from the centromere plasmid to an integrating plasmid. So now you have this fragment of DNA that has what you hope is your favorite gene. It could be a dose-dependent suppressor of your favorite gene. And what you're going to do is use this plasmid to bind on the chromosome where that gene came from. And that's going to be useful to determine whether or not it's a wild type gene. And then you can do analysis. I'll explain that in just a second. But first of all, are we going to target this plasmid to the locus that it came from? So this plasmid carries a piece of genomic DNA, and you want it to be a sort of magic bullet that goes in and marks that fragment, that region of the chromosome in the mark. Well, it turns out that this homologous recombination really works best when you have free ends at the beginning. fragment the plasmid within the sequence that you want to target, so that both of the linear ends of the cut plasmid have homology within the locus that you're trying to mark. These ends are highly recombinogenic, and they will bind to the linear ends. So if you take this plasmid and transform it into a, let's transform it into a wild type. So the goal here is to mark the chromosomal locus. That's the library plasmid. So you fragment the array plasmid within that insert, transform it into a wild type cell, and at a fairly high frequency, the plasmid will locate the region that the chromosome that the baby came from, and there'll be a crossover event. Maybe this is a European or otherwise marked, but usually European marked plasmids. Okay, so this was the chromosome. This was the plasmid that's been integrated there. And the product of that integration event is here. And so this is the full process. Which is effectively done. So kind of want to tell you that. Just, let's say this is the fragment of DNA that's on the side of the attention point. This fragment of it, or this plasmid, is kind of duplicate of everything on there. And in addition to that, it's going to put a zero through mark at that locus on the genome. So now you've marked the region of the genome that was on the plasmid that rescued the TS phenotype for the European marker. How is this going? Now you cross this wild type strain back to your TS mutant. And what would you predict is going to happen? So this is a haploid of the opposite native type of the TS mutant going to cross the strain. So the TS mutant, that if this is the wild type counterpart, the gene that you create to cause the TS phenotype, then the TS mutation and the European marker are there, right? In that diploid cell, one of the chromosomes has the TS mutant that comes on the locus. And the other chromosome that came from the wild type, which is the marker locus for 203, is going to have the European gene. So now, when you're a prospective mitosis, what's going to happen? These are two proximal mitoses are going to get the TS inhibition. The two proximal mitoses are going to get the ERP mark. Right? So you're never going to see a TS proximal mitosis that also got the ERP mark because you had to get one or the other because they're the same gene mitosis. Right? So the prediction is if this is the wild type counterpart of the TS mutant that you marked, then you're going to get every type of that. You're going to get two Euro plus parts of meiosis, and they're not going to be TS, they're going to be wild type. You're going to get two Euro minus. Remember, this strain is Euro 3 minus at the Euro 3 locus. So the Euro 3 locus is minus in all of them. And we're just following the Euro locus that's at the where we're targeting it. Okay. So if they get the TS, then it's a real locus you mark. And then you're not going to get the European gene. So your prediction is in every single peptide, you're going to get two non-TS parts of meiosis, and they're going to be Euro plus. And you're going to get two TS parts of meiosis, and they're going to be Euro minus. Does that make sense? So if you get this result, then you know that you've cloned the wild type gene. What if you haven't cloned the wild type gene? What if you have a dose dependent suppressor? Thank you. if they segregate independently, this locus, if the Euromont locus is unmoved from the TS, the TS can be 2 squared root TS plus and 3 TS minus. So you're completely independent of that. It would be the Euromont 3 locus. Okay? So again, you're going to get between Euromont 2S minus and Euromont 5. If you get those, you know that the Euro locus that you want is not the one that's on the RUG, it's some other locus. And therefore, you have to go to the question. If that doesn't make sense, you should want to do that. It's just exactly analogous to what we were talking about. We were talking about on the inline complementation and the two genes that are getting the same. So what you should do right now is go back and think about why were we trying to do this? What was I trying to work out? And how did marking the wild-type locus that the gene comes from give me a tool to do linkage analysis to see whether or not I had cloned the wild-type gene? Okay. Yes.
Going back to, we have a paper, you have your plasma containing the fragment of the genome that restores the wild type phenotype. So, and then once you have that, you take that plasma, take out that fragment of DNA, you put it in the gift.
Yeah.
And then you're going to go ahead and get the urine 3 marker in there.
Okay, so 97 is the plasma, right? So we need to put genomic DNA that's on that plasma that's removed from the sensory plasma. The reason you do that is because these cells are highly recombinogenic. So when that plasma goes into the yeast cell is going to use its potent homologous recombination system to take those ends and search the genome for what's homologous and then catalyze a crossover. Stick that piece of DNA into the genome of that locus. And so what do we do is mark the Euro 3, the locus, that gene came from. So if that gene came from the wild-type locus that was mutated in the TS mutant, what we've done in the wild-type strain is mark that with Euro 3. And now when you cross it to TS mutant, you've got a strain, but the Euro locus on one of the chromosomes, the Euro gene at that locus on one of the chromosomes, and the TS mutant at that locus on the other chromosome. So when those go through meiosis, it's always going to say get away from each other. But if you put the Euro 3 gene on the Euro 3, this fragment of DNA is not the wild type one, so rather than the genetically expressive. And what you've done here is not to mark the wild type counterpart of your TS gene. You mark the wild type counterpart of the dose dependent suppressor. And if the dose dependent suppressor can segregate independently of the locus, which it will most of the time, if it's not the wild type counterpart of the gene, then the Euro marker is going to segregate independently of the TS marker. Instead of segregating away from it, it's going to segregate completely independently. So you can get the TS mutation and the Euro marker in the same cell, but they're 2 separate local points. So you have the power part of the just the other Euro plus TS minus. But if it is the wild type counterpart of your gene, then Euro is always going to segregate away from the TS minus, so you're never going to get a Euro plus TS by the minus.
I'm confused. Is the Euro 3, is it interrupting the function of the gene then? I guess it's fine. So it looks like the Euro, the way it's drawn up around the board is that the Euro 3 is in the middle of the gene. Am I misunderstanding?
Okay, so you're hitting on a subtlety. That's not, I think it's a good point. You don't want, if this were just a fragment of the gene, right? So let me try this. So let's say this is the fragment of DNA that was on the sentinel plasma. Then you move to the, and let's say the gene is sitting there. But really, you won't know that yet. You haven't really done any analysis to see what's on that fragment of DNA. You're just going to move the fragment of DNA into different plasma. And then you're but what happens when you do that? This is a fragment of DNA that came from the genome. So if this crossover, if you follow it through, this is in the plasma. So you come out along the chromosome, you cross over onto the plasma, and you see everything that was here is here. If you get the Euro 3 marker, So you pick up on this side of game one is here. So you actually end up duplicating that region at the beginning and have your marker in plasma in between. So if this were the gene, this were the gene, you duplicated the gene. You haven't disrupted the gene. Okay, so you just use the European marker and you just put the marker there, but you duplicated that whole segment of the gene. Because the way the crossover works is here's this part of it, now you cross over to this part. Now you've got the whole plasmid. So this is one copy, and this is the other. You're coming along the genome, okay, and you've got this kind of genome, and you cross the plasmid, pick up the whole plasmid, cross back, this is duplicated, but now it's coming from the plasmid, okay, and then you go back, and this is duplicated, this of the plasmid, this kind of plasmid. You should just work on drawing that out and see if it makes sense to you. But that's what's going to happen, okay? Where you can get into trouble is if you have just an internal fragment of your gene instead of the whole thing, right? If you have an internal fragment of the gene instead of the whole thing, okay, so let's say this is an internal fragment that you have on there. So this is missing some sequence from the 5' of the gene and some sequence from the 3' of the gene. Now, you're coming along the genome. Here's the entire intact 5' end of that gene. But this copy is going to be missing sequence on the 3'. Pick up the arrow thing, come around. This fragment is going to be missing sequence on the 5'. So if you had an internal fragment in the gene that was missing essential information on either end, you could disrupt the gene and do the inversion. If it's an essential gene, you'll never get the Euro 3 plus 5 symbiosis because the integration of it is going to disrupt the gene. So this is a good place to start because what we're going to talk about next is how to knock out genes and use. This is one strategy for doing it. Is that what you were thinking? Is that you're going to disrupt the gene?
Sure.
Okay.
I was confused with the word.
Okay. So it's important that if you don't get any transformers, you have to consider the possibility of the way you designed the experiment is that you're actually doing a gene disruption. But since the fragments are so large, usually you don't end up with an internal fragment. Okay. So when we start on Thursday, we'll talk about how to analyze the gene, how to decide whether or not you have the wild type gene or not. And then spend a little bit of time talking about how to do gene knockouts in these, and then we're going to spend most of the time talking about how to exploit the mutants you have to find other genes in the process of interest through genetic interaction strategies of looking for suppressors and looking for things that, so basically looking for other genes that either suppress the original mutant or exacerbate the original mutant. And I'll also talk a little bit about two highway screens that some of you may find useful in your careers as graduate students and beyond.